At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help. So you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Read to Lead podcast, episode 479.
Oftentimes we get really good and we'll start identifying our false beliefs, but then the true beliefs are too hard. So this is what I tell clients. Hey, if it feels too good to be true, reach for that.
Are you tired of chasing a dream you aren't even sure you want anymore? Or have you accomplished your dream only to discover it's not as fulfilling as you thought it would be? Well, it's time to get excited about your life again. Hi, I'm Jeff Brown, and this is the Read to Lead podcast, the podcast dedicated to your personal and professional growth. Exciting stuff. I believe that if you want to achieve true success in business and in life, then intentional and consistent reading is a must. Today, that reading involves a book written by author Heather Penny. She happens to be our guest today, and her book is called The Life You're Made For, Finding Clarity, Confidence, and Courage to Be Fully Alive. I'll be asking Heather to share about asking better questions of ourselves that are going to help us deal with negative self-talk, understanding the role of the givers in our lives and how to make sure to surround ourselves with the good ones, how we can grow stronger by courageously pursuing peace, and much, much more. 1 week from today, we're kicking off note-making mastery cohort number 5. That's right, you have 1 week left to register for our 5th cohort, all about helping you better manage your personal knowledge to make sure that the ideas you capture from the content you consume don't get lost, but actually get utilized, that you can find them when you need them, that when it comes time to sit down and create, you're not starting with a blank page or a blank screen. Note-making mastery is going to help you better collect and capture your notes, better connect and organize your notes, better crystallize, develop, and distill your notes, and better create from or out of your notes. If you want to improve retention and comprehension, if you want to be the go-to person for ideas and insights, if you'd like to see the outputs resulting from your content consumption lead to new connections, well-deserved promotions, and opportunities that were previously out of your reach, then your personal knowledge management system, your notes, is the difference maker, the one thing that, all else being equal, is going to give you the crystal clear advantage. The dates for Cohort 5 are June 20th and 27th and July 11th and 18th. 4 out of the next 5 Tuesdays, we skip July 4th for all the obvious reasons. But we'd love to have you, just a week left to register. And don't worry if you can't make some or all of the live sessions, which, by the way, happen at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Each one is recorded, so you can go at your own pace if you prefer. There again are 4 live weekly 60-minute-ish training sessions delivered by me personally, 4 live unlimited Q&A sessions that follow, a proven process for better collecting, connecting, crystallizing, and creating with your daily notes, a complete roadmap for building your own personal knowledge management system, access to all session recordings so you don't miss a thing, and for a limited time, 3 bonuses. Bonus 1, a $150 discount on the course. Bonus 2, a private 60-minute Smart Notes coaching session, just you and me, scheduled at your convenience. And bonus 3, a personalized autographed copy of my book, Read to Lead. To find out more, just go to jeffbrown.me and get signed up for Note Making Mastery Cohort number 5 before it's too late. Again, that address is jeffbrown.me. Dr. Heather Penny is an acclaimed leadership coach known for fusing practical insights with positive change. She actively guides individuals and teams at global corporations and nonprofits to bigger dreams, bolder initiatives, and better results. She holds an MA in educational leadership and a PhD in human services. If you're going to be motivated to read a book, I can't imagine, and I mean this with all sincerity, a title that's going to motivate you more than The Life You're Made For, Finding Clarity, Confidence, and Courage to Be Fully Alive. I mean, I read that. I'm like, yes, please.
Good.
Give it to me.
That was my goal, man. Put my mission statement right there in the title.
I mean, I don't know how long you worked on that title, but it's been a while since I've been as raptured or enraptured, whatever the word is, by a book title as much as yours. So let's dig in here.
Thanks, Jeff.
And there's a few chapters I just want to kind of dip my toe in the water of, if you will. I mentioned Christina Curtis to you a moment ago. I was just talking with Christina recently about self-care. She came and visited the Read to Lead community and taught a session here recently, and how she used to not take it seriously. And she's since then kind of done a 180 on this and shared some of that. Talk a bit about what you cover in the first chapter of this book, the idea of rest and the art of slowing down, as you call it.
Yes. Well, you'll notice I started my book out with a permission slip. It's just chapter one, and I've got 18 chapters, but it's this awareness that people are almost living as a victim to their lives, but they're the ones creating the frenzy, the activity, the pace, and they're not recognizing they actually have the power to slow it down. So I jokingly say in my work, and I've been, you know, coaching for almost 15 years now, I meet people at these intense places in their life. I mean, they call a coach not because everything's going swimmingly. They call a coach because they're in a crisis, or they're feeling stuck, or they're unsure, uncertain, and they want more clarity, confidence, and courage. But I work with a lot of high achievers, fast moving people. And I feel like the metaphor I use is they kind of swing the door open, say, jump in, Heather, jump in. And I'm like, no. And you're like, and they're like, they're not even slowing down. They're saying, jump in. I need you to help me fix this, this, and this. And I go, I need you to pull over the car so that we can stop and look at this and maybe get out a map, or actually, how about we get out of the car altogether and just take a lap around a rest park? So I use that metaphor throughout the book.
Yeah, that and the four tires, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a little bit. And the tire swing comes to mind, too, with regard to that. Something I'm always trying to learn more and more about and read about more, and I've read a number of books on this topic, is self-talk, the voices in our head. You call it a mind chatter, I think it is. Share about the importance of asking better questions of ourselves than maybe what is typical, and what might some of those questions actually look like?
Yeah, great question. When I in my work with people, the tendency is we are so hard on ourselves, and we know this cognitively. I mean, there's so many people that are talking about it, books written on it, podcasts that are happening, but we aren't really creating strategic methods and measures to start really listening to that inner voice and that mind chatter, whatever we want to call it, that is saying, wait a minute, you don't have to speak this way to yourself. So being able to slow down long enough and listen to what we're telling ourselves, and more importantly, the questions we're asking ourselves. And my favorite example is, when people come to me, it's this constant chatter of, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Can you fix me? Can you fix me? What's wrong with me? And I go, how about we shift the question? What's right with you?
And I love this.
And so as I started shifting the question, first of all, they're like, am I allowed? I almost need another permission slip, right?
Right.
And to be able to have them start feeling this permission to not so laser focus on what they have to fix in their life, but to start really honoring what they're good at naturally. And in that, the other things start dissolving, or the paradigm begins to shift and say, wait a minute, I'm spending this one life so anxious and focused on what I'm not doing well. Mm. When in reality, I can focus on what I'm doing really well and what's naturally right with me, my natural strengths, and how I get to actually grow those and refine those. Mm. Then you see that that's a much better use of our emotional, mental, spiritual energy, shifting away from what's wrong with me. And here's the unfortunate thing. When we ask those kind of questions, we get really good at it. So we get really good at investigating all the areas that are wrong with us. So I jokingly tell people, I'm like, we can get really good at that. We can spend the rest of our life really focusing on what's wrong with us. Mm. I'd like to invite you into a conversation of, let's start talking about what's right with us. And that will counterbalance some of these other areas. I'm not saying that we don't ever get to really look at things that are blocking us, or that we need to overcome, or that we have been believing for too long. But I am saying, if we start fostering our mental and emotional energy in that space, we're using it up to start really shifting over to saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of things that's right with me. And I want to figure out how to honor that, respect that, just like I would for somebody else. But we don't do it for ourselves. Mm. We treat ourselves so harshly.
Very closely related to that, I want you to talk, if you would, about finding the time and space to be ourselves, the time and space to be ourselves. You use, I mentioned, the tire swing metaphor to sort of harken back to some of the more pleasant childhood experiences when summers were simple, it was easy to spend time doing what you loved.
Okay, so it's just my favorite allegory, and I use it throughout the book, but I also made a picture book out of it. But my clients now will get on the phone with me and say, hey, Heather, I need help with balancing my bracelets. And it's just for our listeners, I'll quickly summarize it. It's about this little girl who is given a bracelet growing up and she loves it. It makes her start feeling like she's beginning the adulting process. But then what happens, she gets given more and more bracelets and it prevents her from visiting her tire swing and getting time under the stars.
Mm.
So when we talk about getting time for ourselves, I like to really help clients look at two ways that we do restorative rest. The tire swing really represents an active rest, hiking, gardening, playing, journaling. I mean, just time that you are doing active things and enjoying it. The star time represents a contemplative rest. We need both. And a lot of times you'll hear this competition of the being and the doing. And I want to say it's both. We got to be and we got to do. And we got to find ways to restore our sense of self. So in a culture that I'm working so counterculture with, I realized I had to write an allegory, and that allegory makes more sense to people than probably my 18 chapters. Because once they hear that allegory, they go, oh, and I literally got on my phone. I have people tell me all the time, text me your tire swings. I probably got 10 texts yesterday of these pictures of tire swings. One of them was like a bunch of women who had gone to a facial together, and they had all these funny masks on that almost made me scream as soon as I saw the picture come up. You know, another one was this guy who was flying and he was just enjoying it. He was giving me his aerial views because that was his tire swing. So understanding what we need for that tire swing, which is an active rest, and that star time, which is a contemplative rest that allows us to hear our inner voice or that voice on the wind that calls us back to our sense of self. We all have that within us.
You know, I'm going to be visiting my family this weekend in Indianapolis, and I'm going to have to ask my younger brother his tire swing memories. All my memories with regard to our tire swing was putting my younger brother on it and me and the neighborhood kids spinning and spinning and tightening it up and tightening up and letting it go and watching him spin and spin until he fell off and threw up. So his probably aren't great, but that's my memory of the tire swing.
Yeah, you might need to check that. Maybe replace it with another metaphor. I give you full permission.
Well, at one point, you say that our ability to choose, mm-hmm. and I'm a big believer in this, is greater than we think. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I've worked in a lot of different spaces around the world, and I think every time I return back to North America, I'm shocked at the pace we live and the way we victimize ourselves with our pace. So I have a little bit of a global perspective, and I think particularly in my work in Central America, I was over there in Belize, and the Latino culture, just that slowing down and inviting me in to slow down and actually enjoy life. We maybe got I would fly out there and work with the leaders there in the Ministry of Education. We would maybe get five things done in the duration of my week. Well, for a North American standard, that would be ridiculously low. We should have gotten 50 things done. But I was like, this is so much more enjoyable to live this way. And then I would come back to North America and it almost experience culture shock. We're not made to live this way. And then as a researcher, I started looking at all the studies. We all know this. I don't even have to quote the studies. We all know that we are spiraling down as a culture, particularly in North America, with depression, anxiety, psychotropic meds are in an all-time high. These are all things that are happening. And I want to link it to, of course, there's no easy answer, but I do want to link it to, I think we hold much more power than we know or that we're given, but we're going to have to live a little counterculture. And I'm saying this all my fingers pointing back because I am guilty of it's contagious. Oh my gosh, I got to do more. In fact, the more I do, the more successful I am. I have to change my own belief that says the more I rest, the more successful I am. That doesn't even sound American, does it?
No.
So I think even recognizing the cultures that we're born into, that we're going to have to start addressing and say, how do I want to live a little bit more counterculture? And in the work that I do, I'm calling people out to give them that permission that you don't have to keep up with the rat race. Their biggest fear is, well, what if I'm not successful? Because that's what they've bought into often since birth. So to be able to say, you will, I promise you will, if you just take this journey with me. So when I work with people, I mean, I don't work with them for under 6 months because they, what do they want? They want this one and done quick. Give me one conversation. And I link it to, well, it's like hiring a trainer at the gym and wanting to lose 20 pounds, but you only want to do one session. Same thing with their inner work and our mental and our emotional work. We got to slow it down to really address those beliefs that are have been lying to us for so long. And honestly, the good news is we can change them. We're the only ones stopping ourselves from blocking our clarity and our confidence and courage. So the reverse is true. We can really grow our clarity, confidence, and courage. And that's what I really do in my book. I try and give practical, tangible ways to grow your clarity so that you don't feel alone with this hope saying, oh, she told me I can do it, but I don't know how to do it. I try and walk you through that so that you feel empowered to be able to start doing new practices in your life.
Yeah. And I wanted to hit on one of those in particular. Speaking of beliefs, there's a lot of useful exercises in the book, one of which is helping us understand the difference between false beliefs and true beliefs. Can you unpack that particular exercise for us?
Yeah. So when I was listening to clients quite a bit, you know, some major false beliefs, and I have a false belief bank there where I just started collecting them because I was hearing them all the time. And I thought we can all learn from one another. And so a common one is I'm not enough, or there's not enough time. Those are really common beliefs I hear all the time. And I started labeling them as false because it was a concrete way of like taking a belief and sticking it in a basket and saying, this is a false belief. Now let's reach for a true belief. So let's use the one of time. I never have enough time. I was working with a client, and because she was chanting that to herself for years, you know, as long as probably she's ever known, she had such an antagonistic relationship with time. So when I said, hey, how about we start looking at this new question of how do I make peace with time? Everybody has the same amount of time in our world and in our lives. Some of us have learned how to make peace with it, and some of us live in an antagonistic relationship with it. So the false belief is I never have enough time. Basically, time is my enemy. The true belief then is I have all the time I need to prioritize what I want to get done, or I get to make peace with time. So a real easy way to identify, and here's where I really respect people. I don't want to sit there and ever point to anyone saying, oh, that's a false belief. That's a true belief. I want to sit there and say, hey, let me help you get your clarity. If it's false, you're going to feel stuck. You're going to feel pulled away from yourself, where you're going to feel emotions of anxiety, frustration, depression, and you're going to feel disconnected from relationships and community. Those are three things that help you identify whether it's a false belief. And again, I want to empower the person I'm working with that you get to identify yourself and you get to label it. Once you label it, then I tell people, write it down, cross it out. Now reach for a true belief that's going to help you move forward, connect with higher emotions, you know, your EQ of peace, freedom, love, joy, and helps you connect more intimately and relate with others well. So that's the three criteria that you're looking at. So if you can start identifying what your beliefs are, you can start labeling these are false and true. That, and I will say, and this is a caution I want to throw out there for all the listeners, it's okay if you can't come up with a true belief. I say that with so much compassion because oftentimes we get really good and we'll start identifying our false beliefs, but then the true beliefs are too hard. So this is what I tell clients. Hey, if it feels too good to be true, reach for that. I get to make peace with time. I get to live with joy. I am enough. And then this is where the neuroscience comes in. Practice it for 5 minutes a day for 30 days. That's where it begins to create new neural pathways in your brain.
Something I've been a big believer in and have facilitated a number of these is mastermind groups, sort of what I like to refer to as, you know, assembling your own personal board of advisors that you connect with on a regular basis. And I think something you write about is maybe connected to this, something you call givers. And you talk about the role of the givers in our lives. How can we be sure we've surrounded ourselves with the good ones? Because there are good givers and bad givers, right?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that's a hard question. And the reason I say it's a challenging question is because our life is never static. We may have it nailed in our 20s or our 30s, but when life changes, we maybe have kids or marriages or our careers are shifting or growing or shrinking. We need to actually stop and evaluate, are these advisors still working for me? And then the other thing that happens is those advisors shift and change. And I think that's been the most shocking thing to me, where I was so committed to this advising relationship or this friendship or relationship, either personal or professional, but it shifts and change. I'm a super loyal person. So I would be staying in it, staying in it, staying in it. But I wasn't giving myself the permission to evaluate, is this still working for me? So I think that awareness that life is always shifting and changing, it's okay to stop and evaluate if this is working for you or not, and then be able to address it or shift, whether you address it directly or indirectly, it's up to you. But you want to have that own mindset of who you are selectively choosing to be a part of your various circles that you need, whether it's at the advisement level, relational level, professional level, personal level. I mean, we have all these different levels. And then life is always shifting. And then they're always shifting and changing. We got to give them permission to shift and change too.
I think most people, when it comes to the topic of courage, mm-hmm. would on the surface think of courage as being something that's hard to come by. You know, we put people who seem to do courageous things on a pedestal, right? Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say that courage isn't a scarce resource, that we can actively and intentionally grow our courage?
Yeah, I began to see that people were white knuckling their courage.
Yeah.
and then really proud of themselves calling it courage. And I was just kind of wincing a lot. And I think it's more of my sensitive nature to humanity that said, I think we can do better. And then of course, as in my research, I started looking at it. And then, you know, I had the privilege of working with kids in my 20s and 30s. You learn so much from kids. They're not white knuckling their courage. They're building it. They're engaging it. They're supporting it. We mess it up more as adults. And then we say, this is courage. And I go, that actually feels almost like a violent self act to yourself. It feels abusive and harsh, like lay off. And so that's why I like to end more of the book with this, the courage versus starting it. I want to say, you want to slow down and get your clarity. Be kind to yourself. Figure out your bracelets, figure out your tire swings, figure out your star time, figure out what the voice on the wind is saying to you, figure out your givers in your life. Once you have all that, that clarity piece, that confidence piece, courage becomes a very synergistic, natural response to take a very natural action step out there that should feel energizing, invigorating, a little bit scary and a little bit uncomfortable, but not terrifying and white knuckling it that you survived it. Because you have your clarity and your confidence to really back you up that says, this is uncomfortable and it's scary, but I have to take this next action step. And then when we take that next action step, it's like a domino effect. It just continues to grow and grow and grow. Our courage can also shrink if we refuse to take an action step. And I've worked with clients where I've said, you've got all the clarity you need. You've got all the confidence you need. You're not engaging your courage. You're refusing to set an action step based on it. Because they would rather avoid taking action. And I said, your courage will stay very small and it will stay shrunk. It's like a muscle that atrophies. But if you continue to take that next action step, just like a muscle grows 1 pound, 2 pounds, 5 pounds, 10 pounds, pretty soon you're lifting 20 pounds and you're doing stuff you could have never thought you would have done. But what do we do? That's kind of an act of self-violence is we'll go, I'm going to go lift 20 pounds. And when I'm working with people, I'm going, hey, hang on. Start with a little 1 pound weight first, you know, and we'll move up. I promise you'll get there, but you'll traumatize yourself. And honestly, you'll traumatize other people in the process.
It reminds me of many of the podcast clients that I've coached in years past. I'm going to do a daily podcast. I'm like, hang on, let's not.
Exactly.
There's one guy that did that successfully for 8 years. Let's step back and reconsider that. You mentioned the word survive. You compare and contrast a bit, survive versus thrive. And in a chapter called, I think it's What Fuels You, you share a bit about your own personal thrive plan, the things you do daily, weekly, monthly, that truly fuels you to move forward and make continual progress. Mm-hmm. So you'd be willing to give us a little insight into what that looks like?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I'm feeling a little self-conscious. So I'll be vulnerable here with the audience here, Jeff, because sometimes I'm like, oh, shoot, I'm not doing what I tell everyone else to do. But right now I'm in a season of my life where everything is beautifully growing and I've got so many fun opportunities. I have a harder time saying no to the opportunities that are fun. I've got it nailed with all the stuff I don't want to say no to. I've got really strong boundaries on there. But to be on this side of success when you didn't really quite see it coming, but you worked hard, had your head down and you grew your clientele and your business and speaking opportunities and writing a book. And now I'm kind of have my head up and I go, I want to say yes to 50 things, but I really have to narrow it down to 5. That's very difficult for me. Mm. So what I do is I have to have this thrive plan. I can feel it pulling at me because I just got back from a 4-day trip in San Diego. And as soon as I landed, I've been on the Zoom and phone calls coaching clients since Monday and Thursday. And I can feel a little bit of the wear and tear. So I can feel myself saying, I need to get back to my tire swing. I need to get back to my start time. So how I start my day is critical for me, whether it's movements, some contemplative time, reading some reflective work that inspires me to be the person that I'm reaching for. My spiritual, you heard me talk about my book, my faith is important to me. So reading spiritual truths are really important to me to ground me in my sense of self. These are all things that I have to really pay attention to on a daily basis, meditation, prayer, all these things. So I might start my morning that way. If it's a incredibly trying, hard day, and I've noticed toward the end of the week, I'm like, I might need to do it again somewhere around my lunch hour. Like just pull back and have a connection. Even if it's 5 minutes, like what did I have clarity on with the really cool meditation this morning that I just lost in the last couple hours of conversations that were really intense? The Thrive Plan doesn't have to be perfect. It's really about staying mindful and aware of a daily practice. So the daily, that's important for me. The weekly is, honestly, I work Monday through Thursday and I've been doing this since I started my practice. I take Fridays completely, no clients. That's my weekly practice, whether it's honestly to catch up with them, some things that I want to pay attention to, but I don't do that a lot. It's just stepping out, having an unscheduled space is one of the nicest gifts to give to myself. And then to enjoy my weekend with my family. But that Friday is mine. That's my weekly practice of how I do that. And then monthly would be taking like an overnighter. This last weekend, it was both kind of work and play, but it was something I intentionally said yes to. And I had so much fun the whole weekend. It was a lot of people who had read my books and wanted to talk to me about it. And so I got to sit down and one of them, I sat down and had brunch with them for like 3 hours. That was a tire swing time for me. That was just so fun to engage with people. That'd be more of a monthly. A lot of times I have to make sure I do the solitude. And then an annual is several days away and it's just unscheduled and it's just me time. I call them me retreats. So I'll just go take a favorite place to go stay. And I'll just let go. Sometimes I bring a bunch of books, but I'll read nothing and I'll just watch music videos or I enjoy whatever I want to eat. You know, everything is just how do I let down and not feel productive? That gets me out of that stuck place that many of us get stuck in of trying to survive the next day, the next calendar item, the next agenda. I can feel the weariness in my soul. I can feel a little bit of the fatigue. Listen to where you're feeling weary or fatigue. And I spoke recently and I got asked this question, how do we know? And I said, listen for the sadness. There's a sadness deep within us when we're pushing ourselves too hard. And I can feel the sadness. And it's really more of like, I'm sad because I'm being mean to me. And I think if we can pay attention to that, we can gently course correct and allow ourselves to be our best friend instead of our worst enemy.
And I would encourage others to when they hear you say something like, you know, Fridays is for me, and maybe they work a 9-to-5 job and think, well, I can't do that. Well, I used to think that. I used to hate my commute and just try to make the best of it because I thought I'd always have one. I haven't had one for 10 years. So don't sell yourself short as far as that goes. Be creative. And especially in a post-pandemic world, we've realized things don't always have to be like they've always been, right?
Yeah.
I like your idea of Friday being totally for you. I normally, though we're not recording this interview on a Friday, I normally do interviews on Friday and that's my only thing. And then I have a half day Friday off in the afternoon. But how easy would it be for me to move interviews like I'm doing this one this week to a different day and have Friday completely to myself? I'm going to think more about that. Thank you.
Oh, good, Jeff. Yes. And to your point, the 9-to-5 people, which I've done for decades as well.
Right.
I remember I was teaching and it was an early day, like the kids were out by around 2:30 on Wednesdays. And that was my day. No, I didn't stay home from work. No, I didn't slack off. I gave it everything, but I knew I wasn't going to stay late. There was no faculty meetings. I jokingly beat the kids out the door. Like they're trying to get out. And I'm like, no, it's my day. And I would do anything like take myself shopping or to a movie or relax or take myself out. I chose a day of the week to kind of let down, even though I didn't take the full day off. It allowed me to say, nope, Wednesday afternoons are mine. And it made me look forward to my week. And it also gave me the energy to enjoy the two ends of my week as well.
Well, this brings me to the last chapter 18 of the book, a piece of being. How do courage and peace go together? How can we grow stronger by courageously pursuing peace, as you put it?
Yeah, I thought that was rather audacious. Because I would know, I'm glad you asked me that. No one's ever asked me that, so I don't know if people are getting it or not, but it kind of refers to what we were talking about earlier, Jeff. When I saw too many people white knuckling their courage and thinking that was what was required of them and not recognizing the cost and the toll it was putting on themselves and others and thinking that's what they needed to do. And please hear me. There are times to really just take that leap of faith and go for it. But if we are always mistaking courage with very stressful, anxious writing, thinking and feeling and emotions, we're missing that courage can be also peaceful and exciting and adventurous and necessary. And more importantly, I can get my band of people around me that say, I'm whispering, hey, I think I'm going to write a book. You know, can you stand with me in this? And then instead of white knuckling it through, saying, what's the most peaceful way to do this courageous act? For me, it was to hire a buddy, basically. It's what I call, you know, my writing coach. I was like, and I was dealing with the shame of, you've got a master's, you've got a PhD, you can't write your own book. What's wrong with you? I was dealing with my own shame of what's wrong with you.
Wow.
And realizing I need someone to talk it through, because I've never, one, written a book before, and two, I'm really experienced in academic writing, but I want to actually write a book that people want to read and wants to sell. No one wants to read my dissertation. So being able to be honest about that, of what I needed, and hiring someone and then enjoying more of that process. Yes, it was still very courageous for me, but I was committed to making it as peaceful as possible, because that peace connected to the courage is what's guiding me how to take the next courageous step instead of stressing myself out.
So much of what you said resonates with me. I think I can safely say I'm older than you are. I finally turned out book one at age 55, which was far, far later than I intended to do that. But at least I finally made it happen.
Yeah.
And I was just meeting with my mastermind group this morning, and I was the one on the hot seat. And I brought a book idea, two ideas to the table, and one resonated greatly with everybody in the room, and I got lots of great feedback. So I feel like I now am as confident as I've ever been as to what book number two is going to be. So,
now you have me on the edge of the seat. What is it, Jeff?
Well, I'm going to keep that under wraps for now. I'll tell you when the recording is turned off.
Okay, great.
You know, like you, I mean, I've been sitting on a book idea for a couple of years, you know, and I'm like, and I've written a book, and I still struggle with writing continuously, writing again, writing another one. Am I equipped? Am I qualified? Well, I've done it. I should be, right? So even then, PhD, having done a book, whatever, people don't realize there are still those voices in your head that are going, this thing is not quite right.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's wrong with you?
Yeah. Instead of what's right. Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we've touched on, I think, probably maybe a little more than half the book. What haven't I asked you that you want to make sure we walk away with from this conversation?
This awareness that clarity, confidence, and courage is a really important trifecta. Mm. And the more you practice it, the more it kind of synergistically weaves in and out of your life, and you get good at it. So it's not, okay, first I got to get my clarity. First I got to get my confidence. First I get my courage. Initially, it's like that until you start getting more practiced at it. But then what starts happening is you're on the hunt. You've trained your brain to start looking for, where's my clarity? Wait a minute. I know how to get clarity. I need to rest. I need to pull back a minute. Even if it's a 2-minute meditation, something. Mm-hmm. I know that's where I'll get my clarity. Then my confidence kind of sneaks in, saying, where's the beliefs that are rattling around my brain, and which ones are harming me and which ones are helping me? Which ones do I want to quickly get at rid of, and which ones do I want to bring in? The courage piece then is, okay, what action step do I want to, you know, set today based on that? So I can do this now in under a minute, where I will just pause and pull back. And I think this is the hope I have for humanity. Is the whole basis of my research was we were spiraling down at an exponential rate. And social researchers were calling it a social phenomenon, saying, we don't know what to do. More research is needed. Mm. And so I kind of put my hand up and said, if we can spiral down, we can figure out how to spiral up. I'd like to start that conversation. Mm. And so that's been my life mission and purpose. You can do this. It's so much easier than you realize. And you can hang on to your own clarity and your own confidence and your courage. On your own, you can learn how to cultivate this. And what's really cool then is you can invite other people into that conversation with you. This last weekend, I just got back from, like I said, several communities that have read this book together. Mm-hmm. I can't believe how quickly they're exponentially growing. Mm-hmm. One community just finished the book and went and created a tire swing retreat together where they could introduce tire swings to each other. And so I'm super excited about the fact that I'm getting this truth into people's hands for them to feel empowered. They get to go after their life and they get to take it back and they get to recognize where they've probably felt victimized by their own life. And I just want to be that hopeful voice that says, it's okay. We have everything we need to take your life back and go after what you want. And don't focus on the end so much. Focus on one little step at a time. And here's focus on cultivating your clarity, focus on really increasing your and building your confidence, and then focus on your courage, because it does grow.
I want to ask you a couple of non-book related questions. Well, non-your book related questions. Sure. The first question is book related, actually. and that's a question about the books that have impacted you over the course of your career and your life. Anything stand out as maybe something you recommend to other people often?
Yeah, I think some of the great voices that formed some of my own internal thinking and then led me on this path to get more and more education and to research something that we didn't have language for. Parker Palmer, he's just one of the most wisest sages in our time. He's a philosophical sage. And I think he's in his 80s now, but he's someone that I highly recommend. When I was teaching at university level, I would use his book, Hidden Wholeness, and Let Your Life Speak as a vocational career path. But he does such a powerful job. In my book, I talk about camping at the crossroads. He does such a powerful job of modeling how to pause with you. So Parker Palmer has been a huge influence in my life. And then the second one I can think of is Sue Monk Kidd. She modeled allegory and story so beautifully and then wrote such incredibly spiritually depth-filled books. And I got to see her story and I got to see her inner process. And I've just so admired her over the years as she let us have a peek into her life and taught me how to step into better questions.
Mm. I really appreciate those two recommendations for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is I don't think in 10 years either of those authors have been mentioned on the show. So I always love it when brand new books and authors are referenced. And not the same old, if you will.
Yeah. Well, and I like to mention people who've stood the test of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're not a flash in the pan, and nothing against people that are rising up and not new. And I love all that. And I'm so for people doing that. But these people have been around for decades and they formed me in my 20s. And I've been following them and reading their work. And they have been a consistent, faithful presence to model human growth and development in such a powerful and nurturing way.
I would love to know if you've cultivated any habits with regard to personal knowledge management. We talked about your Thrive technique and handling projects and tasks and to-dos and that sort of thing and making sure things get done. I teach a cohort online called Note Making Mastery, which is a part of the Read to Lead community. The four pillars are collect, connect, crystallize, and create. And walks people through how to build, some call it a second brain, for your knowledge. Most of us have tools that we utilize for tasks and projects. And then oftentimes, at least what I used to do is take knowledge that I collected, maybe from books or articles online or podcasts, and try to stuff that stuff where I try to track my commitments. But I've learned that I need a separate system for that, a separate place for that, a single place where all that stuff is gathered. Whether it's the collection process or capture process or some other phase of that process, any techniques or strategies that you use to help you just manage your personal knowledge or make sure that the things that you come across that you want to remember is saved in such a way that you're actually able to go back and put it to use down the road?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. First of all, I'm thinking I want to take your class because I always would love coaching on that. So that was my first thought when you were saying that. I'm like, ooh, connect, collect, crystallize. Oh, my goodness. I want all that. I am a collector of ideas, quotes, people's books, writing, and I read voraciously. That's why I loved coming on your show. I thank you so much for encouraging us to read, because I think it does. Knowledge is power, and it's changing lives. I did get introduced to a way of journaling that helped me. And here's a basic one of a table of contents. So you just take a journal and you just number the pages. I like doing just blank journals with no lines because I like to draw as well, but I just number it. And then a table of contents helps you. And then you title it and it helps you track what that big idea was. That helps me a lot when I'm getting ready to do a talk or write another book or do something. It helps me gather, wait a minute, I was talking about this in my journal. It also helps me relax. And just journal and freebase, because sometimes you're just getting stuff out and other times you come up with these amazing ideas. So that's what I'm sitting down. The other thing I found is that when I'm out on my walk, if you look at my Instagram page, it's all my epiphanies on my walk. And I get a lot of ideas on my walk and I get lots of thoughts I want to share. And so I learned to start recording it on my phone. Or I have a notes page where I just add it. So I'll add thoughts for writing a book or thoughts for my next blog or thoughts for speaking at this next event. Whenever I'm going to get ready to speak, I always have a page that's running. And then what I learned is, like, if I know I have an event coming up in next week or maybe that's 2 weeks out, I'm letting my subconscious play with the idea of it. So I just got to be ready to have it. When I sit down and force myself to form my talk, it's miserable. That's the white knuckling of courage, right? I want the peace of being in my courage where it's like, oh, I know what I want to talk about on that talk. I know this is the audience that is looking for this, this, and this. And then I'm connecting with my sense of self. I'm connecting with my higher power. And I'm like, what is it that I want to offer here that is the life that I'm made for? What's my clarity on this? So I'm engaging all of that process, but then I want to be able to record it.
You've done a lot of the work just in the natural course of events. When you sit down to create, you don't want to have a blank screen or a blank page. You want to tap into that stuff you've saved and collected. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Perfect.
It's fun then.
Yeah. Well, Heather's book again is called The Life You're Made For, Finding Clarity, Confidence, and Courage to Be Fully Alive. And never a better book title was there ever in existence, in my opinion.
Thank you, Jeff.
Heather, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're so welcome. Such a pleasure to be here.
At the show notes page for this episode, I've linked to the books that Heather mentioned, also where you can find her online and how to connect with her on social media, plus a link to sign up for Note Making Mastery Cohort Number 5 before it's too late. We start next week. Would love to have you there. All of that and more is at readtoleadpodcast.com/479 for episode 479. That direct link for Note Making Mastery, by the way, is Jeff Brown, my name, .me, Jeff Brown, .me. Next time on the show, we welcome MIT's Zeynep Tone, who's written a book called The Case for Good Jobs, How Great Companies Bring Dignity, Pay, and Meaning to Everyone's Work. And we round out June with a visit from Constance Derricks, her second visit to the Read to Lead podcast. She's written a book called Meta Leadership, How to See What Others Don't and Make Great Decisions. That will do it for this week. Hope to see you next time. Until then, as always, remember, leaders read and readers lead.